Okay, we're away here. This is an interview at the home of Lieutenant Colonel H.S. Johnson, and it is the 2nd of July, 1986. My name is Rick Aylward. To begin, Mr. Johnson, could you supply me with perhaps a brief summary of your family background and perhaps your earliest experiences with the military, such as through cadets and whatnot?
Well, I was born in Saskatchewan on a homestead, my father having moved here from the United States. When the war broke out, three of my older brothers joined the armed forces, all in the Signal Corps, and it was determined that I should stay home and look after mother and two younger children.
Mm-hmm.
As it turned out, I waited until 1941, and then I joined the service as well, in the Signal Corps.
At what age would that be?
Oh, I can't recall the year, 41, 25.
25. As you say, you joined the Signal Corps, as did your older brothers. Did they influence your decision to join the Signal Corps, or was that your own entirely?
It was my decision. Because they were in the Signal Corps, I thought I might serve with them in the
mm-hmm.
event.
Mm-hmm.
But no, that didn't turn out to be the case.
Mm-hmm. Can you give me some idea of your duties? As you stated earlier, you were a driver operator in the Signal Corps, I believe. Can you give me just some idea of your duties or your function as a driver operator?
Well, as a driver operator, I was trained to drive military vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
And to operate signal equipment, primarily wireless equipment, both in code and in voice.
Mm-hmm. Did you find, as you say, this is 1942, I believe it's a well-known fact that at the outbreak of the war, the Canadian forces, in many respects, were lacking in their military equipment. Did you find that by 1942, what you were working with as far as wireless telegraphy and whatnot was fairly up to date? Was it fairly?
Well, it was difficult for me to assess it at that time. Mm-hmm. I had nothing to compare it with.
Mm-hmm.
But my recollection of it now is that we had not only adequate equipment, but up to date equipment.
Mm-hmm.
We were one of the first forces on the Allied side to use air-to-ground communication on a VHF-HF relay,
mm-hmm.
for example.
Mm-hmm. Just almost as an aside here, following your enlistment in 1942, did you at that time envision a career out of the Army?
No.
No.
This no,
was
not at all.
So you would say probably that you enlisted primarily out of the demands of war?
Yes, and I felt it was a little, I felt I couldn't leave my three brothers in the forces and not join myself.
Mm-hmm. Was there any, of course in the first war there was much speculation as to reasons for people joining, be out of patriotism, out of love for the mother country, the Queen and whatnot. Was there any of that in your thinking, or was it strictly as a Canadian going toward for the defense of Canada?
Yes, the latter is likely the case. I think
mm-hmm.
at that time my motives may not have been as clear to me as they are now.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I think defense of Canada was the primary motivation.
Mm-hmm. Would you say, or can you say, from your peers in your unit, would you say that would be the primary motivation for the majority of them as well?
Yes, I would think so.
Mm-hmm.
With most of the people I've served with, yes.
Because you also, you often hear also with respect to the Great War, the First World War, many people, particularly in the British forces, going over for a sense of adventure. And did that?
No, a sense of adventure mm-hmm. didn't appeal to me at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'd seen enough of adventure without the war.
Okay, point taken. In October 1942, you were recommended for officer school, and then you were engaged after that in instructing officers in such things as aerial photography, air-to-ground communications, ground attack techniques, and so forth. Could you just describe briefly what school this was, and perhaps describe some of the conditions and the life during this period?
Well, this took place at DeBert, Nova Scotia, mm-hmm. where the 4th Armored Division was stationed there, but we were stationed with an Air Force unit called 123 Squadron, and they were flying Lysander aircraft.
Which was a reconnaissance?
It was a reconnaissance aircraft, 2-seater reconnaissance aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And the bulk of the work was training the people in the Air Force unit rather than cooperating with the Army at that point.
I find this rather interesting, too, that you would have an Army personality such as yourself working with Air Force and training Air Force pilots in such things, as we've said, as in photography and air-to-ground communications. Why would that not fall under the responsibility of RCAF personnel or officers? Or would that normally? Is this something unusual or unique to yourself?
No. Early on in the war, when it became evident that the Air Force was required to operate in support of armed ground forces, it was determined that air liaison people from the Army would be the best means of interpreting the Army's needs to the Air Force in terms of ground support, air attack, and so on.
I see. Okay, and can you perhaps just continue on a little bit with a brief description of, say, a day-to-day, a daily routine that you might have encountered in Nova Scotia while training the RCAF pilots?
Well, the bulk of the time, I suppose, would have been taken up in classroom instruction,
mm-hmm.
Giving them the background in terms of the Army's need for such things as air photography, ground support, fire direction, and so on.
I see.
The good portion of the remainder of it, of course, would be actual work on the ground. The pilots flew over the Tracadie artillery range near DeBert to do their fire direction practices. They did their aerial photography almost any place in the area within the range of their aircraft, depending on weather conditions and so on.
I see. Shortly after that, February 1943, you were posted overseas. The first obvious question: did you fly, or did you go by troop transport?
Well, in February 43, I was transferred to 7 Air Liaison Section, where in the rank of lieutenant.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
And carried out operations, air support operations in support of the divisions that went through Wainwright, Alberta.
Okay.
The Army Division went through Wainwright, Alberta, doing training.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the work was much the same as it was in DeBert, Nova Scotia, except that there was a great deal more of it done in terms of support or work with the ground forces rather than training the pilots, because most of them had the bulk of the had been trained.
Mm-hmm. In essence, then, what you were engaging in at this time, I guess, I'm not sure if this was the term given to it at that time, but I suppose what it boils down to is a form of combined operations between one service and another. That would be the term given to it today. Would you say, in those days, generally, what was the cooperation between Army Air Force? Was it given fully and unconditionally? Were there any, what special problems might you have encountered trying to impress upon the Air Force people the Army's needs?
Well, there is very little of that, because the squadron was called an Army Co-op Squadron. So once they joined it, they knew their major function was to support the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing applied to the squadron in Wainwright, Alberta. It was 168 Squadron, and they had been in operations in the Aleutians, and had returned to Canada about this time. Mm-hmm. They were then given Harvards to do this type of work. And
being a type of training aircraft.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they flew off a makeshift airfield in Wainwright Camp itself, the Buffalo wallows that were in the area of the airfield were filled by soldiers using shovels. The aircraft eventually landed on a grass strip, which
no
was
kidding.
In the middle of the camp.
After Wainwright, you eventually came to command number 7 Air Liaison Section. At that time, you were a lieutenant. Can you briefly describe, perhaps, exactly what a liaison section is, and perhaps what its purpose was and the nature of your duties at that time?
Yeah. Well, number 7 Liaison Section was the section in Wainwright, Alberta.
Mm-hmm.
And its function was just what its name implies, the liaison between the Army and the Air Force to ensure that the Army support that is required is delivered by the Air Force.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Again, there was aerial photography, ground attack, and using in the training sense, practice bombs, and flower bombs when the troops were involved so that no one would get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And reconnaissance, visual reconnaissance.
I see. During this time, you were involved with the training of pilots in what is called air support operations. Typically, what would this involve as far as a pilot is concerned, as far as individual pilots are concerned? What would they have to be, what would their knowledge have to encompass in order to be successful in air support operations?
Well, there was the bulk of the requirement, insofar as they were concerned, was to become familiar with the ground force or Army operations,
mm-hmm.
so that they knew what to expect on when they saw troops deployed on the ground, either enemy or friendly troops. They could recognize them.
I see.
In the same way that they were taught to recognize enemy aircraft, they were taught to recognize ground troops. Their normal sort of formations, how to communicate with ground forces, all of the things that would allow them to go into operations and successfully support the Army.
Mm-hmm, I see. What was your general impression after you reached England in November 1943 of wartime England versus presumably a more tranquil Wainwright, Alberta? It's well known that once the Canadians reached England, there was a period of time where they were inactive. They were not involved in the larger scope of the war, so to speak. For yourself personally, and I guess for your unit in general, was there quite a frustration setting in there at that point, or was it just enough to be there and feel like you were contributing to the war at that point?
Oh, I think it wasn't much of a waiting period for me. I went straight to 129 Airfield at Gatwick. It was later called 39 Recce Wing. And
Recce Wing being reconnaissance
wing.
Yes.
And worked there with the pilots, doing both training and operational work. The bulk of the reconnaissance at that time was the searching out of what is called no-ball targets. They were the B-1 sites on the continent.
I see.
Trying to identify them through aerial photography and visual reconnaissance so that they could be attacked and destroyed by bomber aircraft.
Were you, with respect to the V-1 and I guess later the V-2 sites, were you aware personally of what it was exactly that the pilots were trying to take photographs was? Were you privy to that information, or were you just told that it was a certain target that had to be located, or exactly what with respect to the V-1?
Well, among other things, I was trained in air photo interpretation. Mm-hmm. And we had air photographs from which to locate the target. And then once the target had been verified by our own visual and photographic reconnaissance and attacked by the bombers, we would return to identify the destruction that had been done, return and photograph again.
I see.
To identify their reconnaissance. We weren't always sure from the original photographs we had that a V-1 site was in fact there. It would be suspected on occasion.
I see.
And we would verify it by low-level photography.
Mm-hmm. And the pilots themselves, I guess that would not necessarily be something they would need to know, other than the fact that there was a target under a certain designation, and they were not necessarily told what it was exactly that they were photographing.
Well, they knew that they were photographing, all right, or mm-hmm. attempting to photograph, but mm-hmm. they had no... their main concern was to get a sort of aiming point from which to take their photograph, so that they made sure they got the site, the V1 site in the photograph, and to recognize the typical V1 site, so that their visual description of it, when they if they saw it clearly, they could give an account on that basis as well.
I see. Were there any, with respect to the technology of the time, was there any specific problems or difficulties encountered as far as the equipment goes? Were there any special cameras or night equipment at all that was developed or had to be developed in order to successfully photograph these sites? Or was there any specific or unique contribution by the Canadians in that respect?
Not to my knowledge. I don't know who had developed the cameras that were used in the aircraft. These are all Spitfire aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly there was no night equipment at that time, at least. And we did all of the aerial photography done during daylight hours.
I see. What type of resistance would the pilots in those days encounter? Was there a fair amount of air cover for the German V-1 sites, or was it a fairly uneventful mission to get as far as the V-1 sites?
Well, most of the V-1 sites were relatively close to the coast, and therefore they didn't have to penetrate onto the continent very far. However, they did run into some enemy aircraft, but mostly they were protected by flak, by AGAC guns.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they, I think, encountered more flak than they did enemy aircraft.
I see. I believe also, in connection with the V-1 program, that was there also not a concerted effort to destroy the not only the sites themselves, but also the plants that manufactured the fuels for the rockets as well? Were you involved, or did you have any knowledge of those missions at all?
No, I was aware that that was likely going on,
mm-hmm.
But most of that would have been done by bomber
command
rather
yeah.
than by
mm-hmm.
by the people I was with. We to my knowledge, did no photography on the sort of reserve areas involved in the support of the V-1 weapons.
I see. I'm interested too, once you reached England with the Canadians, what was the reaction of the local population, specifically of your RAF counterparts to the presence of the Canadians? Were they greeting you with open arms, or were you looked upon as sort of a foreign entity? What exactly, how are you received?
Well, we were well received, to the best of my knowledge, by the local people as well as the RAF.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see an awful lot of either, because we were quite busy that period of time. And but certainly any contact I had, either with the civilian population or with the RAF, or for that matter, other allied forces,
mm-hmm.
we were well received.
Mm-hmm. through April 1944, you were engaged simultaneously in training not only RCAF officers in air reconnaissance, this being number 39 Recce Wing, but also at the 1st Canadian Army Headquarters in training Army officers in air support procedures. First of all, could you tell us where this was, the Recce Wing? Where were you based?
Well, the Recce Wing was at Gatwick, as I mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Having served at, finished my tour of duty at the Recce Wing, I was then posted to Canadian Army Headquarters, which is at Leatherhead. And it was there that I was involved in the training of Army officers in air support procedures.
Mm-hmm. Could you just expand upon those procedures just a little bit, or was it pretty much similar to what you had been involved in Canada?
Very much the same.
Mm-hmm.
I neglected to mention while I was talking about DeBert that we also trained Army people as well as Army officers as well as Air Force officers in the ground support procedures.
I see.
And many of the people we trained in DeBert became air liaison officers overseas at a later date.
Would these be exclusively Canadian, or would you be involved in training British or American or Eastern European officers, or exclusively Canadian?
Exclusively Canadian.
I see. This was by necessity or by choice?
Well, it was the way the thing was set up. There were no Canadian, no one other than Canadian Air Force and Army officers involved in any of the activity that I have referred to,
mm-hmm.
up until after I had left,
mm-hmm.
Canadian Army Headquarters.
Okay, I see. Can you, with respect to what I'll refer to as combined operations between Army and RCAF, can you recall some of the major obstacles or hurdles that had to be overcome by an Army person such as yourself in terms of, say, like communications or logistics?
Well, I had very little problem in this area.
Mm-hmm.
I had my own communication system, which was provided by something called an ASU unit, a Army Support Signals Unit, or Air Support Signals Unit, which was two operators with a wireless set attached to me or as part of my staff.
I see.
And then, together with other people in the section, we worked with the Air Force, and all our logistic support was provided by the Air Force. So we had no problems in that sense.
So overall, you would say that throughout your term in England, that the problems were of a very minor nature or even non-existent at all.
That's right.
Yeah. After that time, beginning in April 1944, and indeed up until VE Day, 1945, you're engaged as an air liaison officer briefing RCAF pilots with respect to ground attack missions in support of the Army in northwestern Europe. At this time, I'm just curious as to whether or not you would come into contact at all with intelligence people for any reason at all, whether British intelligence or whatnot, or were you a separate entity altogether unto yourself? Were you involved at all with intelligence per se?
Yes, to a certain extent. Each squadron within the wing I worked with, 143 Wing, Fighter Bomber Wing, mm-hmm. Flying Typhoons, had an intelligence officer, and in addition to that, there was a wing intelligence officer. Their primary purpose was to present for pilot information intelligence relating to the enemy, relating to the
potential targets and whatnot.
No, not so much targets as to the enemy disposition in terms of their air force and in terms of their air defense, ACAC and that sort of thing. That was my job, to brief them on targets.
I see.
And throughout Northwest Europe at least. The wing moved behind the army, keeping in contact with the enemy most of the time. There was very little time in which they weren't in a position to actually attack the enemy.
I see. What would, in your view, what were the principal targets for the pilots under your command in terms of military targets? What would be a primary a target for the pilots? Would it be airfields? Would it be ports? Railroad lines? What would be the type of target that you would be looking at uppermost?
First, might I say, the Air Force was never under my command.
No, I understand.
And the bulk of the attacks that they carried out were using they used 1,000 bombs or 1,000 pound bombs or 500 pound bombs, one under each wing. Mm-hmm. If not the case. They attacked rail lines to cut the rail lines, railway lines.
Mm-hmm.
They attacked mechanical transport, tanks, locomotives, barges, that sort of thing. Anything involving communications on the ground.
Or the transportation. Of militarily related material, I see.
Yeah. And as well as military positions.
I see.
And often we had a ground support unit called a tentacle with the forces being supported, where an air liaison officer like myself could assist in directing the pilots onto a target.
Mm-hmm.
Relatively close to the position of the forces, of the friendly forces.
Mm-hmm. I see.
We would mark the position of the friendly forces with fluorescent panels to the extent that that was sensible, and so that they wouldn't attack our own positions.
I see.
And then direct them using whatever devices we could to show them where the enemy was and where we wanted them to attack.
Would you personally be involved at all with the debriefing of pilots when they returned from their mission?
Yes. I did the debriefing on all of the flights that were done by the squadron I was associated with. Mm-hmm. And some of the other flights of other elements of the wing. We had more than one liaison officer. We had I think four liaison officers with the wing, and we were each assigned to a squadron, and then we had one chap who oversaw the total operation as far as we were concerned.
I see.
We would also receive aerial photographs from the 39 recce wing of the targets we had attacked, so we could identify the amount of destruction which had been carried out by the attack. We did, as I mentioned earlier, first phase photo interpretation. Those photographs, or copies of those same photographs, are out later sent on to a photo interpretation unit which did more detailed evaluation of the attacks.
I see. Can you give me some idea, perhaps, of what exactly a debriefing would entail of a pilot? What sort of format would this encompass? Would you be individually, or as a group, or and what sorts of things would you be discussing?
We usually debriefed whoever led the attack. We'd often do this in the dispersal area. Which is really where the aircraft and the pilots were situated on the airfield. We'd be with them as soon as they landed and were out of their aircraft. And the debriefing was primarily designed to determine whether they had in fact found and hit the target that they were designed, and get their own assessment of the amount of destruction that took place.
Mm-hmm.
And that was then reported to a group control center, which controlled a number of wings, and was sort of a senior headquarters associated with the ground support units. We were incidentally supporting 2nd British Army rather than 1st Canadian Army during these operations, and oddly enough, the RAF were supporting 1st Canadian Army.
Why would that be?
I'm not at all sure. I think at one time I had to answer that question, but I can't recall what it was.
So that was not necessarily a common practice. It was just a unique set of circumstances for that time, or was there? That brings me more or less to my next question. What type of interaction was there, or was there any, between RCAF, RAF, and presumably the RAF equivalent to your own office? Was there much?
Well, because we were in fact separated quite a bit physically by virtue of the RAF supporting 1st Canadian Army and the RCF supporting 2nd British Army, mm-hmm. there was very little interplay, although we had some British Army officers as liaison officers in our air liaison group, and they had the odd Canadian in their liaison group.
Would there have been much exchange of information at all, or were you pretty well much left to your own devices on that score?
Very little exchange of information. There didn't seem to be enough time for it.
Mm-hmm.
We were moving very rapidly. We were on the continent with the entire wing very soon after the invasion. And as I mentioned earlier, we maintained close contact by moving from airfield to airfield while still carrying out attacks. For example, an advance party would leave the current airfield and move to the new airfield site that we would be running the operations from, and sit there and wait until the aircraft landed there. Then they'd take over the operation at the advanced airfield.
Oh, I see.
And the people who remained at the old airfield would move forward, and we would come together again. And I'm speaking now of not only of the air liaison section, but of the entire ground organization.
The apparatus, yep. Sure.
The maintenance, the bomb, the armament people, and the command and administrative people all involved in
it. And
the
support and all the
That's
rest
right.
of it. All I see. Who would be responsible for delegating that target A as opposed to target B would be the target for tonight's raid, for instance?
We got a message during the night from the group control center I mentioned earlier,
mm-hmm.
giving us our targets.
I see.
And giving us any other information that would assist us in identifying or of making sure we hit the target.
Presumably that would include things such as weather reports and whatnot.
Yes, although that was often separate, and we often used a weather patrol early in the morning before we sent anything up.
Mm-hmm.
The standard things in the order were the armament to be carried, whether it was to be 1,000-pound bombs or 500-pound bombs, and the fusing to be used depending on the kind of target. For example, they would use a contact fuse on occasion, or a delay fuse on occasion, or a barometric fuse on occasion. The barometric fuse allowing the bomb to be explored above the target in the air rather than on contact.
Mm-hmm. And a delay fuse being?
Delay fuse allowing penetration before the bomb went off.
I see. That brings me, with respect to communication or lack of it between RCAF and RAF, what was to prevent the two forces from bombing the same target? Would that come from interplay between the high commands of both?
Yeah, that would happen. That design of coordination would take place at Army Group level.
Mm-hmm.
We had two armies, and the territory covered by the two armies was removed. So initially there'd be no reason for them to attack the same target, because one would be supporting the 2nd British, one the 1st Canadian. They'd have different areas of operation, different objectives, and
right.
the targets would be There'd be no overlap in the targets.
I see. After this period of time, after VE Day, June 1945, right through up until May 1946, in other words, almost 1 year, again, you were employed in training pilots for air support, and in fact commanded an air liaison section. I'm just wondering, through May 1946, against whom were you training these pilots for? Germany obviously had been crushed by 1945, June 1945. Was there a feeling after that that, as perhaps General Patton might like to have seen, that the Soviet Union was perhaps going to be the instigator of yet another war? Was there any thought running through your mind, or perhaps through the minds of your contemporaries, that perhaps it wasn't quite all over just yet?
No, I don't think so. When I left the 1-2-1-4-3 wing, it was on it was repatriated. The wing went home. They then needed to maintain a wing on the continent. This is a decision at higher command. It was called part of the occupational force. It wasn't really anticipating, at least from my point of view, I guess from anyone else's point of view, that we would be actively engaged in operations again in that theater, although I suppose the chance of something happening did exist where they would be required. I think their big deal during this period was to take part in an air show at Copenhagen. And there certainly was no
threat involved.
And the idea of training the pilots, I suppose, as it often is in the armed forces, either Air Force, Army, or Navy, was to keep people occupied, rather than having them sit on their hands, to keep their skills mm-hmm. sharp,
mm-hmm.
and keep things going, keep them active.
I see. Did you have, after the surrender of Germany, did you or your unit have any contact at all with the Soviet allies at all, with perhaps Soviet counterparts or?
No, we ended the war at Stella, and immediately I was still with 1-4-3 wing. Immediately thereafter, we moved to Flensburg on the Danish Schleswig-Holstein border, and had no direct contact with the Germans at all, and the German forces, that is.
Mm-hmm.
But this time, I suppose it all been rounded up and they weren't active. They were in concentration areas.
Did you
most of them under German command?
Mm-hmm. Did you at the end of the war, when the fighting had ceased, did you at all feel that you personally would like to have how shall I say, gotten in there and participated in actual active combat or combat related role, or did you feel that your position as a liaison officer afforded you an opportunity to I guess contribute? Was there any I'm not trying to say regret, but I guess that's
I was very busy at
yeah.
the time. It was a very active period throughout mm-hmm. my period overseas up until the VE Day.
Mm-hmm.
And it never occurred to me that I should be anyplace else.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly didn't want to be anyplace else. I was interested in my work, and felt I was making a reasonable contribution.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That was a niche that you found, and you really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I fell into it. I fell into many things.
is now July the 7th, and this is the second part of our interview with Lieutenant Colonel H.S. Johnson. Now, Mr. Johnson, by the end of the war, August 1945, you had been promoted to major, and for the first few months thereafter, you were engaged in training pilots in air support operations. By May 1946, you found yourself back in Canada, in Regina, undertaking what is termed in your file there as special duties. I believe you were a member of a board inquiry investigating what's termed irregularities which occurred during the war. I'm just wondering if you could elaborate a little bit or give me some idea of some of those irregularities.
I suppose the principal one would have been the shortages in the ordnance depot in Regina, where there was several millions of dollars unaccounted for in the ordnance depot.
Mm-hmm.
And we went through the activity of the ordnance depot throughout the war and discovered that a lot of the losses were likely just a change of nomenclature, a recorded mistake. Mm-hmm. For example, calling a water tank, a small water tank, a tank, which is a fighting vehicle.
Uh-huh.
That kind of error.
So they were largely
accounting errors,
oversights, and whatnot. Yeah. Was there any one thing or one irregularity, so called, that stands out in your mind that was somewhat apart from the usual?
No, there was nothing, nothing really unusual about any of the work I did during that period. Certainly not in that investigation. It's amusing, I think, that I think we found that the variation that occurred, even though it was several millions of dollars, was something like 0.02% of the 0.002% of the total volume.
So we're talking really about a very minute
handled by the ordnance depot throughout the period under investigation.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested too here. How an air liaison officer such as yourself, how was it that you came to be selected for this investigation?
Well, I really came back to the district depot as almost anyone would coming back from overseas at the end of the war, going to their original depot for disposal, usually discharge.
nice term.
I really anticipated being discharged.
Mm-hmm.
And it was during the period of waiting for this to happen that I was, because I wasn't actually on staff at the depot, but rather in attendance, that I had been given special duties of various kinds,
mm-hmm.
most of it pretty routine.
Pretty routine, yeah. Mm-hmm. I know you were in Regina for approximately 5 months, and in September, the fall of 1946, you were posted to Shiloh, Manitoba, and the Parachute Training Center, which was being set up there. And I guess you were involved with the selection of personnel and preparation of staff for what was to be a new joint air training school. Was this the training school at that time, was it conceived to be a center for training Canadians strictly, or would there be allied, such as American, British cadets is there as well?
Well, it was designed primarily for training Canadian personnel of the three services in all aspects of joint operations involving three services.
Mm-hmm. So
from parachuting to the work I was doing during the war.
So parachute training center is something of a misnomer then, insofar as you say it was all aspects.
Well, it was the parachute training center at Shiloh. Mm-hmm. Once it moved to Rivers, the parachute training center became the parachute training school, one of the schools within the joint air training center.
I see. Did bearing in mind this is 1946, the war is barely over 1 year. Did World War II style tactics in combined operations, were they, was the idea of the center, the training center, to sort of pick up on the lessons learned, so to speak, from operations such as D-Day, for instance? Did operations such as that influence the training that went on at this center, or was this envisioned as perhaps a center for a new and untried tactics?
Well, it was a bit of both, really. Was to keep alive the kind of cooperation that went on between the three services during the war, and to develop new techniques and new procedures for mm-hmm. for that sort of thing.
I see. would you say overall that the center lived up to expectations? Did it perform as expected or
yes,
hoped for?
I'm sure it did. It was a very active place and had naval, Air Force, and Army people not only on staff but going through the center under training. For example, a squadron of naval pilots from HMCS Warrior spent a considerable period of time at Rivers one summer doing all of the things I've talked about in terms of Army cooperation.
Would you say, overall, that the concept of combined operations was readily accepted by all three services? Did Army, Navy, Air Force, obviously there would be certain obstacles and hurdles to overcome, but overall, was the concept fairly widely accepted by all three branches of the service?
Yes, I think it was. The war was still fresh in everyone's mind where that kind of cooperation went on during the war, and it was quite easy to perpetuate it mm-hmm. in a sort of training situation at the Joint Air School.
I see. Now, you were involved there actually for a couple of years, or for a couple of months, excuse me, sorry. Then in October of 1946, you were attached to the RCN as a carrier-borne liaison officer. Was this something you requested, or was this an out-and-out transfer to RCN service?
It wasn't something I requested. Matter of fact, I requested my discharge while I was a child, and not thinking of the Army as a career. And because I wasn't really very active at Shiloh.
At Shiloh, mm-hmm.
I got a little fed up and asked for my discharge. And the commandant got in touch with Otto by phone, and they were told to hang on to me because
your experience.
And they had worked for me, and a little later on, they arranged to fly me to Ottawa, where I was sworn into the what was then called the Interim Force, and in the rank of Captain Acting Major. Retaining my major's rank on an acting basis, and I was sent to the Warrior, flown from Ottawa to what was then RCF Station Dartmouth, and soon to become HMCS Shearwater, and went aboard HMCS Warrior.
I see. How did you, being Army, so to speak, how did you adjust to life at sea?
I rather enjoyed it. It was a new experience. I remember quite vividly the first day out of after leaving port, Halifax. We ran into a typical Atlantic storm, and there were only two officers aboard ship who were in the wardroom. That of the entire complement of officers aboard the ship who were in the wardroom that night. The rest of them seemed to be ill. I was one of those too.
So not surprising.
I rather enjoyed it.
How did you find naval discipline as compared to that of the Army? Would it be much different, or would it tend to complement what you would expect as far as Army discipline went?
Yes, I think it was what I would have expected aboard ship. I've had. There's no basis for a comparison that would highlight any substantial difference.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Their administrative procedures in the disciplinary sense were different, but
overall, the way it would tend to complement what you.
That's right.
I see. I know while aboard the Warrior, you were responsible, amongst other things, for the indoctrination of naval officers. Could you perhaps just explain a little bit what is meant exactly in that context of the word?
Well, again, it was a continuation of the work that went on during the war. Training, there was the Fleet Air Arm, in a Canadian sense, was relatively new. And the HMCS Warrior was the first Canadian carrier. Some of the pilots had served aboard RN carriers, but this was the first Canadian carrier.
And the Warrior, was she not actually, she was built in Britain?
That's right.
For service with the Royal Canadian Navy, is that right?
Well, I'm not certain it was built specifically for service with the Canadian Navy, but it was, I think, on loan mm-hmm. to the Canadian Navy from Britain.
Mm-hmm. Was it not, and I'm not sure what the term came from exactly, was it not considered one of the so-called baby carriers? Is it one of the...
It was a small carrier, but it wasn't a baby carrier in the sense that those carriers which were used for escort duties during the war, they were much smaller.
Mm-hmm. Overall, during your service on the Warrior, would you say that the Army-Navy connection, did it seem to work well within the framework of combined operations? Was cooperation forthcoming between the two services without much difficulty?
Oh, yes. There was no problem at all. The pilots were very receptive to the kind of thing that we were trying to teach them.
Mm-hmm.
Because it gave them something to do other than just fly the aircraft. And the senior staff aboard the carrier were very cooperative, and we had no problems in terms of getting the job done, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. In your opinion, from the viewpoint of a naval pilot or a Navy pilot, what would be sort of the underlying or the most important aspect of air support that he would have to master?
Well, I think...
What would he encounter, in other words, in support of the Army that would be somewhat foreign to his experience at sea?
Well, he'd be attacking shore bombardment by naval craft. Destroyers and cruisers and battleships, being directed from the air by their pilots was something which would be unique for the Canadian naval pilot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I would think perhaps a more exciting aspect of their work, that kind of thing,
uh-huh.
where although they were also taught to attack themselves, and often did attack a towed target behind the carrier with dummy bombs as a training routine, which I think they enjoyed as well.
Would you say overall that at the conclusion of that program, or at least at the conclusion of your term on the ship, would you say that they were relatively successful in mastering what it was that you were trying to teach
them? I don't think there was enough opportunity while I was aboard to bring them to the efficiency that would be normally expected of them if they were to go into combat on this basis. But most of those people eventually went to Rivers. I mentioned this earlier.
Rivers, Manitoba.
Once the Joint Air School was set up, and there again, they went through the same kind of training as the Air Force pilots had. And I think at that time, they were ready to do almost any of the work that had been done by the Air Force, by the RCF, during the war. They were very well trained, although no combat experience.
Right, right. Just jumping ahead a little bit here, a year or so. January 1951, you attended the Canadian Army Staff College in Kingston, Ontario, which, or at least at where you obtained a qualification in or as PSC, and I'm just wondering what that is all about.
Well, the PSC insignia means past staff college. It's the qualifications.
I see.
That,
okay.
That you get if you successfully complete the staff college.
Okay, I see. Early 50s is the beginning of the era of the tri-service college. Generally, to the best of your recollection, what was the feeling amongst yourself, amongst your colleagues and yourself with respect to the concept of the tri-service institution? Was it, in your opinion, a good thing?
Well, I wasn't very familiar with the tri-service college. Activity. Are you referring to the defense college at Kingston?
Yes.
Rather than the staff college?
Yeah, yes.
I see.
Sorry.
Yeah. I know the defense college was a very attractive place for most of us. I don't think there was a soldier, sailor, or airman who wouldn't have liked to have attended the defense college. It was. It was an indication you were going to go someplace if you didn't make it.
I see.
Because
I'm just curious because I've heard it mentioned in some quarters, particularly it seems by senior naval personnel that there were some grumblings at the time that it would have made more sense from the viewpoint of some people had the Navy had its own institution strictly for naval training, the Army, the Air Force.
Yes. Well, of course they had those,
but just the for some
they're
of the
not old, at that level
for some of the old school, I guess, just the concept of tri-services all under one roof, sort of speak, I guess, rubbed the wrong way, I guess, in certain.
Yeah, it may have been. I wasn't aware of it. Mm-hmm. Certainly in relation to the defense college.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the people, and we saw quite a bit of, while I was at the staff college, we saw quite a lot of the defense college people. And there was no indication that this sort of feeling was there. Certainly it was, at my view, a waste of money to have three such colleges.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was a high-level study course designed to indoctrinate senior officers in the three services in aspects of defense that they wouldn't normally come to in contact with in any other institution.
Mm-hmm.
Within their service or within government.
I know you qualified, as did your colleagues, for entrance into the institution by examination. I'm just wondering how you were graded on that. Would that be a pass-fail situation, or would it be percentile? And if you failed it, could you take it again in order to gain acceptance?
I think people did fail and were given the opportunity to try again. I can't be certain of that. My memory fails me in that area.
I know you came seventh out of 125 people, so failure was certainly never anything on your mind. But I'm just kind of curious, what type of, on the entrance exam, what sort of a question would you be asked? Strictly military?
Yes, basically a military questions.
Mm-hmm. Theoretical situations.
Yeah,
right? Yeah.
I can't recall the details of it now.
Mm-hmm.
And most of us were put through a period of intense training, either just after the test or before. I guess after the test and prior to going to staff college,
mm-hmm.
so that that we could hold up our end, so to speak. I went to the infantry school at Borden, for example, and spent, I think, a month there in rather intensive training in the infantry.
Yes. That brought me to my next question. Aside from a written exam, there must have been some sort of physical criterion by which you were judged. No?
No, I don't think so. The fact that you were in uniform and
that was considered.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I don't think there's any special medical mm-hmm. associated with this because there was no physical test carried out at the school.
Mm-hmm. From Kingston, for the next 2 years, 1952 to 1954, you find yourself back in your home province of Saskatchewan at Saskatchewan area headquarters. I'm just wondering, given your experience on the warrior and in the war and whatnot, did you find this, as
quote, a soldier. Did you find Saskatchewan at that point of your career? Was that a fulfilling position to be in, in as much as Saskatchewan is a little bit off the beaten path, so to speak? Did you find it, was it enough of a challenge for you to stay in the Army at that point?
Well, there was a good deal of satisfaction in this, because having been accepted in the interim force as an acting major, mm-hmm. I was now confirmed in my rank, in the regular force, and I had successfully completed the staff college, and had received a staff appointment, which was the ultimate in
sure.
once having gone through staff college,
sure.
to get getting a staff appointment, grade two being the level at which a major would normally serve as a staff officer.
Mm-hmm. What, while in Saskatchewan, while you were there for the 2 years, what exactly was the nature of your duties?
Well, as the GSO2, I was sort of the right-hand man, the right-hand of the area commander, responsible for all aspects of training, intelligence, both in the militia as well as in the regular force, and for cadet training. And of course I had other officers who assisted me in this area. I had a cadet training officer, for example, had an intelligence staff, and so on. And it was a very interesting period. I saw a great deal more of Saskatchewan than I'd ever seen while I lived there. having to go around and inspect cadet corps and visit militia units, and of course conduct the training at Dundurn Camp for the militia.
Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious too here, with the term Saskatchewan area headquarters, at that time was the country broken up provincially by each province was designated a certain area headquarters?
No, or there were a number of commands, and the commands were broken down, usually by province.
So you would have the western region, the central, the eastern, and then subdivided again?
Yeah, we were in Prairie Command, for example.
I see.
And Prairie Command had Saskatchewan area mm-hmm. as a subordinate element of the command.
Mm-hmm. You actually remain in Saskatchewan after your time, after 1954, you stay there till 1956 as company commander of the Queen's Own Rifles of Canada, which I guess is, or was, one of the most prestigious units in the Canadian Army in those days. Would you say that a command of that type, particularly in view of the prestige attached to that particular unit, would that be analogous to a naval commander, for instance, who is commanding his own ship as opposed to being on a shore appointment? Did you, you must have derived a lot of satisfaction even at the company level of commanding men of a unit with that type of stature, with that type of a reputation, so to speak.
Yes, I must first of all indicate that this wasn't in Saskatchewan.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I
beg your pardon.
The battalion was in fact in Ipperwash in Ontario, and I joined them in Ipperwash.
In Ontario, sorry.
They were on at this point scheduled to go overseas. Insofar as the relationship between my appointment as company commander and that of a naval officer with his ship, I think he was in a much better position, or a much more prestigious position, because he was on his own in a ship. I was part of a battalion.
Mm-hmm.
My company was part of a battalion.
Mm-hmm.
There was very close supervision over the company's activities by the commanding officer, while he would be commanding a ship and masterfully surveyed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I guess what I was really asking there, not to get too too abstract, but I was just sort of curious that as a soldier, when you have a command like that, so to speak, in the field, is that when you would feel most fulfilled as a soldier?
Well, yeah, yes, there was a great deal of satisfaction in being posted to a battalion.
Mm-hmm.
I had been an infantry officer from the time I was commissioned in 1942, and I'd never been in an infantry battalion. And had been told by the director of infantry in Ottawa and that I wouldn't see an infantry battalion.
So then did it come as a surprise to you when you wound up with the Queen's Own Rifles?
Well, not entirely, because the director of infantry changed in the next one and told me that he'd had to get me to a battalion as soon as he could. And so off I went to join a battalion, and not only was I a sort of raw recruit, but I had the recruit company, and all of the soldiers who joined the battalion from the day I joined until we went to Korea, and that was only a matter of weeks, mm-hmm. where all recruits didn't have their uniforms, had no training.
Was it difficult in those days to get recruits for the army?
I don't know whether it was difficult or not.
Did you ever have any experience in shortages of men in terms of what you needed to fill out a company, for instance?
No. I suppose we could consider the fact that they were still sending them to the battalion as civilians for training as soldiers, mm-hmm. and raw recruits that late in the day before going to Korea, mm-hmm. on a matter of a few weeks, that there must have been some difficulty in recruiting, but I have no evidence other than that.
Yeah, I would imagine in those days too that the prestige of the armed forces would be still relatively high, if not very high.
Yeah.
Unlike today, where they have sunk somewhat in the eyes of the public, I think. You mentioned Korea a couple of times, and I presume that the unit went over there as part of the UN peacekeeping force. What were your impressions personally once you reached Korea? Were there any fears expressed to you by any of the UN personnel there that the conflict could erupt again, or was there much tension on the peninsula when you finally reached it?
Yes, I had no contact with the United Nations personnel other than other soldiers in the UN force. And there was always the threat, I think, of a renewal of conflict. We certainly were very diligent in manning the demilitarized zone to make sure that there were no unannounced incursions by the Chinese or the North Koreans.
Mm-hmm. I know while in Korea you served as a liaison between the Commonwealth Division and the U.S. Corps. Generally speaking, did the two work well together, or was there really that much contact between them?
Well, there was a great deal of contact in the sense that that they worked very much the same within the U.S. Corps as they would have had they been in a British or a Canadian Corps. Mm-hmm. And those contacts were much the same as they would be under those circumstances. The fact that we had some variations not only in uniform but in procedures and in our standard operating procedures, the way we did things, mm-hmm. often caused some amusement. There was never any consternation about it.
Uh-huh.
But it was a normal relationship.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious too, from the viewpoint of military personnel such as yourself and the unit, bearing in mind that in the 1950s, particularly at this time, the Cold War was gearing up, and there is a lot of rhetoric from many quarters as to the nature of the threat and whatnot. Did you, as a soldier, as a military person, when you were in Korea, did you have the feeling that, or did the UN troops generally have the feeling that they were there, right on the forefront, the front lines, fighting international communism, or was it looked at in a more detached way as a military operation without the overtones of ideology thrown in there?
Yes, I don't think that there was more attention paid to the military aspects than there was to the political aspects, mm-hmm. be it international, mm-hmm. But everyone was aware of the Cold War. It was always there in the background.
The background, yeah.
And you all got reports back from how the conferences were conducted at Panmunjom, where the two sides sat facing one another and made sort of rather silly comments back and forth, based on one-upsmanship or whatever. It just, you know, that aspect of the Cold War was there and noticeable.
Mm-hmm. But you would say generally for the average soldier on the ground that it was more just viewed as a military.
That's right.
And the ideology was definitely secondary.
Yeah.
While you were there, was special attention paid or was much made of the infiltration of agents from the north at all into the south? Were you aware or under orders to be especially conscious of such maneuvers by the north?
Yes, that was one of the reasons for manning the demilitarized zone, was to make sure they did not penetrate it. We were very careful to do this. There were occasional incidents. I can recall one where, while I was at I Corps headquarters in Weijiambu, a North Korean patrol crossed the DMZ and had a firefight with a South Korean Marine Division.
What would be the purpose of such a... Oh, just to raise tension?
Get information, raise tension.
See what kind of defenses it would be facing?
Yeah, probe the defenses, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And the Korean Division sent out its own patrol and killed most of the North Korean patrol. So that was one incident, and it was startling enough that the Corps commander called a conference the following day of all of the divisional commanders to, I guess, make sure that they remained alert to this kind of problem and to brief them on what had gone on.
Sure, sure. I know after Korea you had another abrupt change of scenery, beginning in August 1956 and for the next 5 years, in fact, until the fall of 1961, you were posted to the Directorate of Military Operations and Plans in Ottawa, and while you were there, you helped to prepare what was called the Canadian Army Defense Plan and Program. I presume that this would be concerned in large measure with a nuclear war fighting scenario in Europe or elsewhere, wherever the war could possibly break out. Would that be fairly accurate?
Well, the bulk of the work in that sort of area was designed to meet Canada's military commitments from the Army point of view,
mm-hmm.
in relation not only to the defense of Canada as it was anticipated with Canada acting on its own, but also in meeting its obligations both in NATO and in the sense of continental defense,
mm-hmm.
Canada-US.
Right, I see. Was the plan or the program, was it prepared in conjunction at all with perhaps similar plans in Allied armies? Was there any consultation back and forth, or was it strictly a Canadian undertaking tailored for Canadian needs or requirements?
Well, it was a bit of both. The Canadian Joint Board on Defense, the Canada-US Joint Board on Defense, was perhaps the motivating agency behind the military aspect of these plans. And there were a number of committees and working in this area.
Mm-hmm.
And we just developed our plans to meet the obligations that were accepted under these plans and conditions.
I see. I know in conjunction with that plan, you were involved also in preparing plans, for instance, to aid the civil authorities, NATO, the UN commitments, and even other federal government departments. where would you personally fit in here? Would you be sort of the general directing things, or would you be actually in there coming up with these plans and yourself, or would you have a staff that you would more or less oversee?
Well, I had a staff of three, four, five officers at various times during the period, and we developed the plans for approval by the military committees within the headquarters.
I see.
And we served the joint staff needs, providing the feed from the Army point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Everything we did, of course, was presented to our superiors within the armed forces, in the sense that they went first to the...
Okay, we're back after that interruption by the telephone, and we're talking still here a bit about the plans developed by the Director of Military Operations and Mr. Johnson's role in them. Did you personally have authority to give assent to these plans, or was this, once a plan was drawn up, was it sent upstairs to whomever for final approval?
Initially, the plan to go to my director, the Director of Military Operations and Plans, if he approved it, it would then go on to the Vice Chief of Staff,
mm-hmm.
Who would likely present it in council, and before it goes any place.
Mm-hmm.
Then, if it involved an international commitment, of course, depending on the degree of commitment, it likely went to the minister's office.
Mm-hmm. And ultimately, I guess,
to the prime minister, to cabinet, before there was any commitment made.
Mm-hmm. With respect to the Army Defense Plan, was this something that would be revised annually, or was this projected over a 5-year period, 2-year period? How would that work exactly?
Well, it was continually updated where necessary.
Mm-hmm.
It was really designed to meet all our commitments. It was one big plan to meet all our commitments.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, a general plan, it would be drawn up, and as circumstances dictated,
be amended.
It would be amended, yeah. I see.
Each it have various segments to it to meet
mm-hmm.
anything involved, continental defense, NATO activities, or whatever.
Following your stint with the Directorate, beginning in November 61 and going through till August of the following year, you were the senior staff officer at Target Area Headquarters in Windsor, Ontario, by which point you were Lieutenant Colonel. You were involved there with developing plans in consultation with municipal, provincial, and federal authorities for what is termed survival operations, and I would presume this would be civil defense, in essence. What to do in the event of nuclear attack? Along those lines.
Yes, I think there is a distinction between civil defense and survival operations. I'm not quite sure where it is,
mm-hmm.
But in this context, we were to form the nucleus of a headquarters that would look after operations in event that there was a contamination or an attack that affected any of the three counties, Essex, Kent, and Lambton.
So it was, I guess potentially, it was a setup designed for a post-nuclear scenario or a post-nuclear attack. In order to, that there would be some sort of authority or some central nerve in the aftermath of a nuclear attack.
Yes, it was, anything that went on up to the point of attack was planning for that eventuality.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How, in those years, of course you're just prior to the Cuban crisis, how seriously within the military was the threat of such a war viewed in those years? I think, given the fact that on the one hand you have the Cold War rhetoric from both sides, also I think given the fact too that in those days at least, American superiority was reasonably unquestioned. How, from the Canadian military viewpoint, how seriously was a nuclear war threat taken?
Well, I think the threat was taken more seriously than any time prior to or since that time. Because it was during that period that all of the sort of hardened sites were developed, which protected governments and mm-hmm. military headquarters.
These would be the underground bunkers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the Army was directly involved in this, in the sense that they manned the communications associated with it and often manned these sites on a continuing basis.
I assume in that respect, too, there would be provision made for facilities for the Army and forces, commanding officers in general. There must have been provision made where they could go to an area of safety as well. Would this have included someone like yourself?
No. The people that would go to those headquarters would have been people in a very senior position.
Mm-hmm. Within government and military.
Within the government and in the military.
Mm-hmm.
In order to provide the continuity of government and not have the Army acting entirely on its own mm-hmm. in the face of all this.
Mm-hmm.
And the continuity of government was really the essence of survival operations, apart from saving lives and property.
In that respect, in that latter respect, had nuclear war broken out, was the idea of evacuation of massive populations seriously entertained? I mean, in terms of a big city such as Toronto, for instance, was the idea for them to basically hit the highways and stream northwards or wherever?
I can't speak specifically of Toronto, but certainly of other cities. I'm aware that the evacuation plans were developed,
mm-hmm.
The controlling agencies often did exercises involving a mock evacuation.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure you must have had your own analysts during such an exercise evaluating the validity of that. Was their conclusion that an evacuation would that be a feasible thing to carry out, as far as you were aware?
Well, I can't really, I'm not qualified to speak on it, because no evacuation actually took place.
Mm-hmm.
The evacuation plans that were made seemed feasible. There was no way of testing them in a hard sense, in that you couldn't duplicate an atomic attack or a nuclear bomb and have its impact influence what was going on.
Who, in the event of an attack, who would have been responsible for carrying out, well, we'll say an evacuation? Would that be strictly military, or would that be military in conjunction with police and other authorities, or who would have jurisdiction?
Well, the civil defense authorities, with each element of government and the survival operations people in the forces, would have been the system of coordinating with mm-hmm. civil authority.
Mm-hmm.
At working level and at senior level, it would have been the premier of the province with the local military commander in his province.
I see.
Or area.
After your posting to Windsor in the target area headquarters, August 1962, for 3 years in fact, till August 1965, you were GSO level one. With the Canadian Defence Liaison Establishment in London, England, responsible, I believe, for relations between Canadian forces in England and the British Army. What typically would be an area of concern for Canada with respect to the British and NATO meetings that took place over there?
Well, I think the there were two separate things, the British, the liaison with the British forces, and NATO. There were two separate.
As opposed to NATO, there were separate.
Yeah. The liaison that was carried out was not a, was more to learn from one another.
Mm-hmm.
We could draw from their experience and
vice versa.
And they had people in Canada who could do the same thing in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So we visited their military establishments, visited their schools. We arranged for students to go to from Canada to their schools.
Mm-hmm.
We attended their exercises when they had military exercises. We obtained information from the British on any subject that we were notified, or there was a notified interest from Army headquarters in Ottawa.
In Ottawa. Mm-hmm.
It was much like the embassy activity in a foreign country, but on a military level as opposed to a diplomatic level.
Did you have, in essence, free rein while you were in Britain, or were you under while in England, would you be under the operational orders of Ottawa or the British Army while there, or both, or how would that work?
Well, there was a Canadian defense liaison establishment in London headed by a...
Would that be attached to the Canadian Embassy, or would this be separate?
Well, he had responsibilities to the embassy, mm-hmm. but it was a separate entity. It was housed in Grosvenor Square, quite some distance from the embassy.
So they were actually physically separated.
Physically separated. And the establishment was headed by a brigadier, and it had its normal three elements, Army, Navy, and Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
And the Army side, on my arrival there, was headed by a colonel. And I was responsible to him.
Mm-hmm. To your knowledge, did such a liaison establish, and I assume there would be one in Washington too, another...
Canadian Defense Liaison Establishment, Washington as opposed to London, yes.
Yes. Did to your knowledge, did such establishments survive the unification? Did unification have any impact on them at all? Did they survive in much more or less the same form, or was there any impact there at all, other than administratively?
I doubt it. I can't speak authoritatively on it, but the three elements that exist in the armed forces after unification were likely duplicated in the liaison establishments, because that kind of expertise was needed in order to deal with the three elements and the other forces.
I'm curious here too, did you personally find out, throughout your career you served as liaison in various capacities with the Navy, the Army, overseas in Britain. Did you find in general a liaison type post comparing the various liaison posts that you held, were they relatively constant, or what was a significant difference between, say, being a liaison officer between our Army and our Navy within the context of our country, and being a liaison officer between our forces and a foreign or another country's forces, such as the British? Would there be any significant differences, or would it be...
Yes, there was a substantial difference, because while I was on liaison with our own forces, I had, during wartime, an operational role to play, which had a substantial contribution to what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And in peacetime, a direct hand in training, but liaison with the British Army or with the American Army was quite a different thing. It had no role to play in the sense of influencing what was going on, but rather to make sure that the interests of the Canadian Army or the Commonwealth Division, as it was in Korea,
mm-hmm.
were identified to the corps commander. I can relate a story
by all means.
Show this, for example, although it isn't typically Canadian. During the period I was with I Corps at Wijeonbu in Korea, the nationalist Chinese sent a delegation to visit the U.S. I Corps. And the I Corps, without consulting me, had set up an itinerary which involved them, the nationalist Chinese delegation, visiting the Commonwealth Division.
Was that, as you say, they did not consult you, was that an oversight, or was that...
An oversight.
It was not deliberate then?
No, it was an oversight. They eventually got a copy of the itinerary, but I found out they had scheduled a visit to the Commonwealth Division. I asked to see the Corps Commander and told him that it wouldn't be right for the National Chinese to visit the Commonwealth Division because Britain did not recognize Nationalist China. They were recognizing the Communist China at this stage. Mm-hmm. And the Corps Commander was quite upset because he had issued the itinerary to the Chinese, and he suggested that I should get in touch with the division and see if they wouldn't accept them. And I said, I don't think it would be fair to ask my divisional commander to do this. It would be much better if he were to cut it off at Corps headquarters by delaying the tour of the other elements of the Corps to the point where he didn't have time to make the Commonwealth Division and then make that excuse. And so he accepted that. That's one thing.
So you have to be, in essence, you have to be somewhat of a diplomat, in a sense, mm-hmm. In terms of inter-force relations. You have to be very diplomatic about, you know.
Yeah, you're really trying to make things work
mm-hmm.
between the two agencies that you're associated with. There was another incident which was amusing too, if you'd like it on the record.
Sure. Well,
that during some of the maneuvers within the Corps in Korea, the operations officer at Corps headquarters came to me and asked for me to ask my opinion on what would happen if he were to ask the Commonwealth Division to withdraw from its position it was occupying to another position some distance back,
mm-hmm.
to the rear. And I said, if you asked them, they wouldn't go. If you told them, they would go. He was quite surprised, and I said, well, I call the Commonwealth Division and ask the GSO-1 there what you should do in this regard. He got the same answer from the division as I had given him. If you want us to move, order us back. If you don't want us to move, we're in a better position where we are.
Mm-hmm.
So don't ask us to go.
point taken. I guess finally here, as a postscript to your career, towards the end here, after your liaison establishment posting in London, you find yourself back in Ottawa from August 1965 through February 1967 as a member of the Defense Staff Secretariat. And I'm not sure I'm too familiar with that body. What was that body all about? And secondly, does it still exist in either the same form or an altered form in the post-unification era?
Yes, it still, to the best of my knowledge, still exists. It certainly existed up until the time I left the forces. And unification was well on its way by that time.
Sure, sure.
It was a staff headed by a officer of brigadier rank, either Army, Navy, or Air Force, and it was a joint staff. It had all three elements were represented.
Army, Navy, Air Force.
Army, Navy, and Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
Or ground, air, and sea, is there?
Yes.
We're
using correct post-1968 terminology, yes.
And work was primarily to serve the Chief of Defense Staff and his senior counsel. Mm-hmm. So that their needs were met in terms of communication with the rest of the forces. That their offices were run properly, their information was timely, that their administration of their offices was done properly, and so on.
I see. How did the events of those of your final 2 years, as you say, unification was well on the way, how did unification affect your career, or did it? Of course, you know, this is your active career is winding down, but did it have any impact at all upon yourself, in your opinion? And perhaps you can offer your insight as to what you think of it, what impact it had on the Canadian forces in general.
Well, it had no direct impact on me. I had been involved with the other two forces to the extent to where this was a heart-rending situation.
Sure.
As far as I personally was concerned, I'm well aware of the rather heated emotions or extreme emotions that were generated as a result of this activity and the other.
Yeah,
in all three.
I know the Navy was particularly rocked by a series of high-level resignations. What, in your opinion, would you say would be the most, this may be a little strong, but most damaging, what aspect of unification?
Well, there are two sides of the situation, pros and cons. I wouldn't like to talk about a damaging one as though...
From a purely military standpoint.
Yeah, but as though there were only damaging elements come out of this.
Yeah.
I think perhaps the one that shook both of them the most was the loss of the sort of regimental spirit in the Army.
Mm-hmm. Such as the Queen's Own Rifles disappearing as... The Queen's Own Rifles.
They still exist in the sense that the regiment still exists.
Yes.
But the loss of the uniform, a lot of the trappings that went with regimental activity on the Army side, the Navy and Air Force had their problems as well, and most of it seemed to depend on the kinds of things that, rightly or wrongly, the forces thought of as being those which maintain morale mm-hmm. of the forces. I think that is perhaps accurate at the time, but I think its impact doesn't exist any longer. I don't think that...
Unification is well far along enough now. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That many of the people who are now in the forces are really not very aware of any other sort of situation.
Or have little recollection of sort of the past traditions and
Well, they're likely are, but no first-hand knowledge.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, Lieutenant Colonel Johnson, we are rapidly winding down here, but I would just like to take this opportunity to thank you for taking time out to conduct this interview and spend some time with us and. Giving us this recapitulation of your career, and I would just like to thank you very much.
Fine. I'm glad you've done it.